Couple of things. Perhaps a better word. Yeah, linguistic justice. We don't normally use this word justice, do we? Maybe a better word would be respect. No reason why socialists shouldn't use that rather than justice. It seemed to fit anyway in all the in that last quote that you gave us in the two or three instances it was there. Just mentioned that. You talked about when you've got time. I mean, you talked about dead languages, as it were, reviving languages thought dead coming back. I wonder if you know anything about Hebrew in Israel, because that's a funny one, isn't it? Because I mean, the kind of language that's spoken in Israel is sort of classical Hebrew. It's sort of old Hebrew. I'm not sure what happened to it. Maybe did it die out and then was sort of politically brought back again. Not sure, but if you know anything about that. Third thing that occurs to me is that Welsh is categorizing that, is it the UNESCO, that UNESCO thing as a language which most children speak, even if they don't go on to use it regularly. Absolutely not true. I mean, most children in Wales don't speak Welsh. I mean, some do. Obviously, if their families are Welsh speaking, and it's a small proportion that are, will learn Welsh. They go to a Welsh medium school, they'll probably learn it as well, though lots of them sort of don't carry on to use it. But you're talking about a small proportion there. So I'm surprised that it get Welsh sort of gets put into that category by UNESCO of all bodies.
I take the point about respect. Yeah, sure, fine. Yeah, Hebrew. I really didn't say much about it because it's a bit controversial. My understanding is that Hebrew was no longer a spoken language, but it was used in religious contexts, and that's how it came to be revived. As you say, it's a rather sort of classical, literary kind of Hebrew, I think. In a sense, these are all special cases. I guess Hebrew is even more of a special case, but it's not revived in the way that supposedly Cornish has been. As for Welsh, I think a lot of the languages didn't really seem to fit into those categories that I mentioned. And Manx, I don't think, for example, really is to say the youngest speakers are grandparents and older. I don't think that's true about Manx. I suppose to some extent these were sort of pigeonholed into particular categories. When it says that most children, I think maybe that has to be seen as most children, most kids within a kind of, not taking Wales as a whole, but taking perhaps a sort of the Welsh-speaking parts of Wales. I don't know if that makes much sense in a way that North Wales would be a much more Welsh-speaking area than South Wales, for instance. But I think however you classify these languages, there's bound to be an awful lot of unclarity or controversy about it, really. Okay, thanks, yes. Mike Foster?
Thanks. That was a really interesting, and it's a subject I haven't sort of thought too much about beforehand, which means I don't or didn't know too much about it beforehand, which means my these comments might be a bit might be sort of coming from a place of ignorance as much as anything. But I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the Welsh language is sort of more visible now than it maybe was, I don't know, 40, 50 years ago, in the shops and signs in shops and things tend to be in Welsh. I'm sort of assuming that that's there's been a bit of a revival over that in previous decades. But that, with what Howard said, that made me wonder how many people actually, that their default is still reading English, even though the old language is being preserved. And I think it should be. I think it should be sort of propped up if needed and sort of promoted. But I'm guessing some people who want to preserve the Welsh language and promote it more so are doing that from sort of nationalistic motives rather than, you know, sort of cultural preservation type motives. There probably might be a fuzzy line between the two. But yeah, I suppose my vague point there was wondering sort of to what extent efforts to preserve languages, and maybe the same applies to Manx or even Cornish, is bound up more so with nationalism than with, you know, sort of, as I say, sort of preserving cultural heritage, or you know, maybe that's a false dichotomy. I haven't thought that through. But yeah, another quick point, and I'm not best versed to make this, that there are others who I think aren't here tonight who are much more experts in Black Country dialects than myself, being an adopted Brummie. So yeah, I can't really comment on that. I can't say I was aware that particular use of language was prominent, particularly around Dudley, but again, I don't sort of move in those circles. But what one thing I have noticed with the Black Country is you only need to travel a few miles down the road, and the accent and some of the words used sort of differ, very different to Birmingham, you know, which is, you know, say only a few miles away. So there's, you know, a Dudley speaker might be subtly different from a Stourbridge speaker, for example. But yeah, I don't know, again, hopefully it's the same in other parts of the country. I didn't notice it so much in Suffolk, that, you know, there are changes in language, even, you know, over quite short distances. And again, I don't know if you get that with, you know, languages like French or Italian either, or if that's a particular quirk of English. But yeah, anyway, I'm rambling now. But yeah, thanks very much. Yeah, cheers.
Yeah, I mean, clearly there are local variants of languages, and that really does apply to all languages. The book I took that stuff about Dudley from was specifically based on research in Dudley for some reason. I'm not quite sure why they chose that. It may just have been that they had a sort of an in to the Black community in Dudley. Doesn't imply that it was at the time different from what was spoken elsewhere. Nationalism, yes, certainly. I think certainly the use of Irish is very much as a nationalist, and use and promotion of Irish very much has a nationalist connotation to it. People who write about this tend to say that language and culture are not the same, and that therefore losing a language is not the same as losing your culture. But I did read something that said that reviving Cornish was to do with reviving a culture, but I'm not quite sure what that would mean really in terms of the culture. And one thing I think I forgot to say in the talk was that when a language is on its last legs, it's very often women who are the last speakers, since languages which are, whatever it is, critically endangered or severely endangered, they tend to be spoken mostly in the home and in the family, in the community, rather than in the wider world of work and so on. I think that does that answer what you asked, Mike, or some kind of answer anyway?
Great, thank you. Yeah, cheers.
Brian.
Yeah, just wanted to point out in respect to Welsh, and in regards to the difficulty, it's hard to be taken up, you know, by the population in Wales as the language of the country. First off, people need to know that Welsh developed from the Romantic languages, right? And also is a very meaningful language, but very, the place names in Welsh explain the surroundings. Words like Penabryn, right, means pen, means top or edge or end, right? And Bryn means bank or mound. So when you have a place name like Penabryn, what you'd be looking for is a edge or a mound of a bank, right, or a top bank and all the rest of it. The same goes then for Penacoin, coin meaning wood, right, or forest, right, so you'd have top forest, etc., right. And you don't have this going on in English. You don't call something top forest, etc. Just a plain name like Manchester and London, and that's it. As far as the meaning is concerned, it's either lost to us It's got no meaning. That's the difficulty with the Welsh being carried on. The third difficulty with Welsh being carried on is that it's a tribal language, right? It affects the tribe. And Cornish is another tribe of Celtic language, same as Brittany. They're all within the same tribe, the Celtic tribe. But they have, like you've explained, they all have the little differences in regards to the Celtic language, the spoken Celtic language, etc. The difficulty that Welsh has got with technology, the difference, you know, in the words that come out. For example, Ablands, right? The Welsh language commission has gone and done. It's gone and done. Pronunciation is exactly the same, but the spelling is different. You got ambulance, right? In Welsh, and the meaning is conveyed easy enough. Like, no, so that's what's happened. But to me, anyway, it illustrates difficulty languages have if they don't keep pace, or they're unable to keep pace with the scientific of pronunciations of the language, or the technical pronunciations of the language. Like I say, if they're not straightforward, that's it, and then they chuck back on. And the other difficulty, like I pointed out, is the meaningfulness of the language, where you have place names, etc. That is a difficulty. There's other things as well, but like you suggested, Paul, a lot of it is controversial. That's all I've got to say. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Paul Edwards.
Yeah, hi there, Paul. That was extremely interesting. It's a fascinating subject, and it's something that I've lived with from a very young age. I've always been interested in it, pretty much by default, having a mother who was German-born, German-speaking. She had this sort of strange way of speaking when she was on the telephone, or unusual, so we say. She could flip between, if she was speaking to a neighbour, she would generally speak fluent English. If she was speaking to one of her friends who came from Germany, she would flip between speaking in German and speaking in English. And if she was speaking to a brother or sister who was in Germany, it would be fluent German. It was an incredible experience. I used to be very confused by it at a young age. And that was compounded, if you can call it that, by my dad, who on rare occasions, when he was speaking with his dad, my granddad, dad was from Wales, Pembroke Dock originally, and whenever he was speaking to his dad on the phone, he would flip between English and Welsh, which was very interesting. It's kind of stayed with me. Likewise, I've got an auntie who lives in a place called Pollock Shields in Glasgow, and she had a neighbour who spoke fluent Gaelic, which is actually making a bit of a comeback in some of the Glasgow schools. I think there is one school in particular who only teach in Gaelic. Might be a sort of semi-private school or subsidised by the Scottish Government. And they would shout across the tenement buildings to each other. My auntie was from Ireland, and it was like a broken Irish Gaelic, and Scottish Gaelic. And again, that was another fascination. So what I'm saying is just the diversity of it all helps sort of bring a lot of fascination and interest to it. So that was why I particularly chose to tune in tonight, because it's something that I really like to learn more about, which he certainly succeeded in doing. I know that you're talking about, there's international language, local language. I get cut off accidentally there. Mike was talking about, I think it was accents and dialects and stuff like that. And of course, there's quite a lot of variety here in Scotland where I'm from and where I obviously still live. There's sort of slang Glaswegian, which is more of your accent, but it is recognised. But then there's another sort of offshoot from you know, further north you go, there's a language called Doric, which is practiced in around Grampian in the Aberdeen region. And then when you go that little bit further north again to Orkney, there's Orcadian and things like that. I always remember, again, going back to my childhood, watching a programme with, I think it was Wicker's, Alan Wicker's World, or Wicker's World with Alan Wicker. And he once travelled to one of these kind of far-flung African countries where they actually spoke in a series of clicks as well as actually speaking their own sort of language. It was interspersed with clicks and things, which was astonishing too. So yeah, I mean, there's so much there, and I'll finish off with one other thing after asking a question, which will be of interest, because I know that you're quite knowledgeable about China and Chinese, Paul. Talking about justice and things like that, I remember during the COVID situation with that clown Boris Johnson, when he was on giving his daily talks and warnings and things. The government, or he in particular, refused to have a sign language interpreter at the side of the platform that he was speaking from, despite many, many requests. Now, unlike in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, you know, I'm not bigging up the Scottish government by any stretch of the imagination, but the importance of, you know, equality and respect. The Scottish, when Nicola Sturgeon was saying her thing, they had a sign language person at the side of her platform or lectern or whatever you want to call it. For every single moment she or he was there speaking in sign language, which is, you know, that is a formal official language. Never used to be. It's only been the last few years been recognised as a language. Bear in mind, there's also an American sign language as well as British sign language. And so a group of deaf people brought the government to court, and they won. It was discriminatory. You know, it wouldn't have cost much when you think of all the money they were spending not to have an interpreter, a sign language interpreter. So, you know, maybe there's some element or argument there for the term justice as a result of the lack of respect. But that was, and there's another one as well for learning, non-verbal learning disabled people called Makaton, which is a slightly slimmed down, or simpler, version of sign language. It includes a series of gestures, hand gestures, and what's the word I'm looking for, pictorial type things too. But what I was going to ask you at the end of all that, and thanks for your patience and listening to me further along here, what would you say I suppose it's individual, but what is generally recognised as the most difficult language? And I obviously already sort of alluded to what I think the answer might be, although it can be subjective. But what would you say, Paul, in your experience or knowledge, is generally recognised as the most difficult language to learn? Probably not difficult for children at a young age. But, you know, I think we probably know that the older you get, the harder it is to learn anything. But in particular languages, what would you say, in your opinion, was the most difficult language to learn? Thank you.
Gosh, I don't think I'd want to answer that, really. I mean, I think a language is difficult to learn is... Firstly, if you're learning it as an adult, then one which is very different from your native language or from other languages that you know, where you don't have anything similar in terms of vocabulary and so on to learn. And also languages which have, like Chinese and many African languages, which have different tones to convey different kinds of meaning. And that's something which English doesn't have, for instance. Other than that, I suspect that the hardest language to learn is whatever the next one you want to learn is. You know, it depends so much on the individual speaker and what their existing linguistic knowledge is, to be honest. Yeah. With regard to sign language, I think sign languages are sometimes classified as being, or that people look at them as if, do they count as being endangered or not? Yeah. Yes, I also remember seeing Nicola Sturgeon speaking and always or nearly always having a sign language interpreter alongside her, which I was actually quite sort of pleased to see. Yeah. With regard to the African languages, the clicks are part of the languages very often. So what sounds like a click to us is actually a kind of consonant sound. So let me try to pronounce this. There's a language, I think, the name is spelled X-H-O-S-A, and it's pronounced something like Khoza. So the click is actually part of the language. It's a sound, just as T and P and Th are part of English. So they sound different. Maybe those are difficult for people who don't have, who learn language without those sounds in them to learn. But they are part of the language, yeah.
That's fascinating. Thanks. Well, I suppose it's not a little bit like if you hear an English person talking about Loch Ness, whereas it's more often not a Scottish person will describe it as Loch Ness. Unlike that. Thanks, Paul. That was a great answer. Thank you, Comrade. Yeah.
Perhaps one thing, as I did give all the examples of endangered languages in the British Isles, but Scots is listed as vulnerable, like Welsh. That's not Scottish Gaelic. That is Scots as a possibly a variety of English. Also classified are Romani and Yiddish are described as definitely endangered. In that's in the UK, not internationally, in that UNESCO classification. Joy.
Well, hi, thanks, Paul. I wanted to say how much I think language vocabulary reflects the culture of a society. I mean, talking about the two languages that I'm most familiar with, obviously English and Italian, what comes to mind is that last week I was taking a class and one of my students was telling us in Italian she was doing some gardening and she'd got a new shed. Now, we all knew exactly what she meant by shed. I couldn't think of a word in Italian for shed. I could think of a word that was a sort of generic term, but it didn't conjure up the idea of what we think of as a shed. You know, you immediately know in English when somebody says, oh, I've just been out to the shed. Another word was to leave home. You know, if I say to an English-speaking person, I left home when I was 18, they know what I mean. If you say to an Italian, sono partita quando avevo 18 anni, they just think you said, I went out when I was 18. The concept of leaving home is not an intrinsically Italian concept. You know, you're expected to stay at home forever, practically. And the other one, which I always find astonishing, is privacy. There's no word in Italian for privacy. The word in Italian for privacy is privacy. You're not expected to have privacy in Italy. Your family are all invading, and it's not a concept which is even thought of. I just wanted to make the point that I think so many words reflect the culture of a society. Thanks a lot.
Of course, some people say it's the other way around, that the culture reflects the language. When I did a talk on language a couple of years ago, I did talk about that idea, linguistic determinism, which I don't really hold with. But people would say, I think, maybe, that because there's no word for privacy in Italian, therefore there's no concept, which does strike me as a bit daft. But there are no Italian-based Creoles, I think, because Italy wasn't very good at colonising. Is that right? Howard?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Sorry, I don't know. I couldn't unmute myself. I can probably answer that last question, by the way. I don't know about Creoles in Italy. There are loads and loads of local and regional dialects. Loads. And I was going to ask you the question about 6,000 languages in the world. Depends what you call a language, isn't it? I mean, somebody once said, I'm sure you know this one, a dialect is a language is a dialect with an army and a navy.
Yeah.
Most of the dialects in Italy don't have an army and a navy, but some of them, they're very, very different from one another. Some are recognised sort of, as it were, officially now. It didn't used to be, but quite a few of them are now. But loads of others. Which are not sort of, as it were, recognised officially, haven't got the same status. I mean, the vast majority are, as you yourself were saying earlier, developments of Latin. They're different sort of ways in which Latin. But you know, there are languages in Italy which are of Albanian origin, for example, Greek as well in the south of Italy, still spoken. I mean, I would think they're sort of very much endangered now too. So, and As for, yeah, I mean, Creoles, I suppose there are people, yeah, a lot of people in Italy, Joy will confirm this, who speak sort of part the national language and part the dialect when they sort of, you know, when they communicate. That is very common, actually. Yeah. Mm. But I was putting my hand up for something else. I've sort of forgotten now. The question of Paul's question of what's the most difficult language. I think you did give the right answer, that it depends what your native language is. And, you know, I was a language teacher, so I sort of know one or two languages, Italian, French, reasonable amount of German, etc. And actually, I know a bit of Yiddish. You mentioned it was dying out. I don't think anyone speaks it now, do they? But
which language was that?
Yiddish.
Yiddish. Oh.
Yeah. My parents used to come out with quite a lot. So, they used to say things in Yiddish when they didn't want myself and my brother to understand what they were saying. Once I started doing German at school, they couldn't do it anymore because I could understand what they were saying. They're so similar. It's a sort of medieval version of German, isn't it, Yiddish? But anyway, point I was making was that, my daughter-in-law is Japanese, and I thought it would be nice for me to learn Japanese, not to speak to her because, you know, she's done pretty well in English, but to speak to her family who don't know any English. So I'll learn some Japanese. I went to a Japanese class. I failed miserably because it was too different from any of the other languages I knew. There weren't any hooks. You know, the European languages, you learn, there are all sorts of hooks to do with words and the way the way things are expressed. With Japanese, it was so totally different that I'm afraid I sort of, my memory is terrible now, so I couldn't remember the words from 1 week to the next. And I sort of quite quickly gave up. But the concepts are so different as well, aren't they, from one language to another? I mean, in Japanese, for example, you may, I know you're a Chinese speaker, but I'm not sure the extent to which you know any Japanese, but in Japanese, in European languages, if you want to count things, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there's one word for each number, isn't there? It's either 1 or 2 or 3 or whatever. In Japanese, there are 4 or 5 ways of saying 1 or 2 or 3, depending on whether the thing, the number qualifies, is abstract, concrete, big, small, etc. So if I want to say sort of, I don't know, two concepts, the word for two is one particular word. If I want to say two dogs, the word for two is different. It's a different word. Because a dog is a sort of animate thing, concrete thing, and a concept is an abstract thing. For example, there are about 5 or 6 of each. So you've got to get your head around that, which isn't easy if you're used to there being just one word per number. Anyway, sorry, I'll stop there.
I've forgotten what you said at the start now. In terms of the number of languages, it's difficult to say. That's what I said, around 6,000, I think. Firstly, as you said, trying to define a language is very difficult, as the difference between a language and a dialect. But also, in many parts of the world, it's simply not at all clear how many languages are spoken, whether languages have died out or not. And there are places, Papua New Guinea, for instance, where which are still unexplored. Nobody knows which languages are spoken there and so on. With regard to Japanese and Chinese, Chinese only has one word for any of the numbers, but what's different is that in between the number and the noun comes something called a classifier. And if you said in English, a cup of tea, cup would be a classifier. That's different from a pot of tea, roughly similar. I think Japanese may have something similar to that, but it's not the numbers that vary in Chinese. It's the bit that comes in between the number and the noun. Did you start learning to read and write Japanese?
The teacher was Japanese, but she was sort of, you know, doing it via the English alphabet to start with. But I never got as far as that, I'm afraid. No, I.
Yeah, that would have been even tougher.
Yeah.
Paddy. My understanding is that in South Korea, the writing system is a mixture of what are called Hangul, which are the Korean symbols, and Chinese characters. And I assume rather fewer Chinese characters are used in Korean than in Chinese. It's only true that in Japan, fewer Chinese characters are used in Japanese than in Chinese. So in South Korea, it's a mixture of Hangul and characters. But in North Korea, it's the Hangul only. I think they don't use Chinese characters in North Korea. I suppose that, in a sense, it's easy. I don't know any Korean. I just know a little bit about it. And I suppose it may well be much easier to learn just the Korean symbols and not the Chinese ones as well. The Japanese system is very complicated. They have they're not quite syllables, but syllabic type systems plus characters. And there are often the characters have two ways of being pronounced, the Chinese way and the Japanese way. So it's that is amazingly complicated, yeah. But there are plenty of other examples of new writing systems being developed. Some years ago, I'm not quite sure when this was, but in Haiti, many Creoles are not really official, don't really have official ways of being written. They're just written rather casually. But in Haiti, because the language, Haitian Creole supposedly has some official status, they tried to do a spelling reform in which nasalized vowels, things like on and un, which are written in French with an N after the vowel, so on is written O-N in French, they tried to change that in Haitian Creole so that nasalized vowels were written with an a, with a circumflex accent, that's a little hat type thing, over the vowel symbol. So on would have been written with O with a circumflex accent, but people objected because it looked so un-French. I think they had to drop it, you know. So some attempts at spelling reform work, some attempts at writing reform work. In Chinese, there's been this quite long-going spread of more simplified versions of characters, for instance, and that does seem to be efficient and effective, yeah. Several letters that were used in Old English are no longer used in English these days.
But Paul, sorry, can I just say something? Sorry to butt in. I mean, don't we have to distinguish between, first of all, Chinese and Japanese in that they're different language, the script, some of the script may be similar, but they're different language families. And Korean is actually part of the Japanese language family, or Japanese is part of the Korean. So Korean should be radically different structurally and in terms of vocabulary from Chinese, much more like Japanese. That's my understanding anyway. Not that I know a word of Korean.
I'm not sure that's true about the language families, but I think Korean has quite a lot of Chinese loan words, so it can look at if it's written in the Roman alphabet, it doesn't look Chinese, but bits of it are reminiscent of Chinese. Put it that way, it's not quite the same thing. Yeah, the same would go for Japanese, I guess. Because many of the Chinese characters in Japanese have Chinese readings, and so they will sound a bit like Chinese. Yeah.
And since no one else has got their hand up, can we sort of say something about language and nationalism? You touched upon it earlier, or somebody touched upon it anyway. It's hard to disentangle the two, isn't it, in the modern world anyway? There is a link between, say, being a Welsh language supporter and a Welsh nationalist. I'm not saying all Welsh language supporters are Welsh nationalists and vice versa, but nevertheless, the two tend to be sort of fairly closely bound up. It's because of the kind of society we live in. I mean, we used to have a member in the branch, he's no longer with us, in Swansea branch, who was a Welsh speaker. And he was dead keen on the Welsh language. He was anything but a nationalist. What he used to say was that in a socialist world, what you might call minority languages would prosper because, you know, because cultural diversity was a good thing. Cultural diversity would flower in a way that in capitalism it can't, because it's a question of, you know, what's most, which language is most, is it most profitable to sort of use, etc. And I think that's a good point. I think it is very hard to, you know, to sort of to disentangle language from nationalism in a capitalist context, and perhaps it wouldn't be in a socialist world.
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously we can speculate about what would happen in socialism, and maybe using your term respect, that people would get respected, but whether that would stretch to, you know, 6,000 or even 4,000 languages might be a bit hard to be sure about that, and can't see, be sure about that now. Yeah. Yes, I certainly, in many cases, language and nationalism are closely related. Irish, I mentioned, I think Dreadhorn may well be the same. Yeah. Yeah, but they're often closely connected, but they're not the same thing, clearly.
My apologies.
Okay.
I'm just going to ask if I could comment. Sorry, Paul. Sorry, folks. Yeah. I thought you'd finished. I was just, because I know I end up forgetting what I was wanting to say unless I just spit it out. Just on that nationalist thing, and I think it was a lot of the Nats that in Wales and in Scotland who were responsible for campaigning for Gaelic, Welsh wording on street signs, directional signs and things like that. You see a lot of that in Wales and in Scotland too, and I think it was a sort of a nationalistic thing to have Gaelic introduced on those many years ago, and you see it almost everywhere now, apart from maybe the very, very old signs. I'll just throw one more other thing, if anyone wants to comment on it, and particularly yourself, Paul, and that's what's your thoughts on the language Esperanto? That never really seemed to have come to anything. So sorry for jumping in, Dougie. I'll leave it at that. Thanks, comrade.
Yeah, I mean, Esperanto, as a supposed international language, it's very romance-based. Vocabulary very much taken from romance languages. And also, it has gender on nouns and adjective agreement, all the things that English doesn't have, and therefore, in one sense, maybe a much more suitable international language, yeah, which, you know, obviously it's becoming that already, yeah. I suspect that the bird of Esperanto as a international language has flown really since English already has that role, really, yeah. Thank you.
Hi, Paul. Yeah, very interesting. I was out in Nigeria a while ago or whatever, just for a few weeks, when I was looking for clay for a company or whatever. And, you know, what struck me was, you know, the trying to unify the country under, you know, nation state of things, you know, having one language dominant or whatever. And, you know, I think there's different tribes and things like that. But, you know, they were trying to make everybody proud to be Nigerian, you know, showing athletes jumping over hoops or whatever, or pole vaulters or whatever, you know, on the television, trying to encourage nationalism, right, you know. And the language thing was encouraged as well, right, you know, to speak English or pidgin English or whatever. So I think when countries have different people, you know, speaking different languages, the dominant society tries to get them to speak one language or whatever and have be one nation rather than different tribes, right? Yeah, that's all I wanted to say, right? Yeah,
yeah, I suppose in that kind of context, maybe English is the most likely choice anyway for a national language, and in other cases, it would be French and so on. Yeah, Paddy. Does that mobile translation technology, does that imply just to the main languages or to almost all languages? Well, exactly, all the big ones, yeah. And what maybe what would happen is something that happens now, you know, people who don't share a native language will converse in English or French or something like that. Yeah. So maybe that would happen in, you know, if you pointed your translator at someone and it translated your language into English and their language into English and translated it back, yeah, that kind of thing, yeah. I don't know. Who knows? I mean, who knows what will happen, yeah. Perhaps Adam knows. Adam.
Yeah, sorry. At one point, you said that most people in the world are bilingual. In fact, presumably most people who are not bilingual are people who speak English. Would that be a fair?
I don't. Yeah. Well, most of them probably do speak English or, you know, maybe Chinese or something. Yeah. By being bilingual, I mean people have a fluent or competent knowledge of two or more languages. So learning a bit of French at school doesn't make you bilingual.
No, but I mean, I imagine there are people here looking down the list who can speak more than one language or can. But most people in England or Britain won't speak another language. But on the question of learning languages, I mean, Howard mentions his problem with learning Japanese, but surely the best way to learn to speak a language is to speak it. In other words, if Howard found himself in Japan, he would soon pick up speaking Japanese. I mean, I remember the case of a party member. I don't know whether the Scottish Commons were remembering, called Ian Williamson. I mean, he went to work in Japan as a barman, and he picked up Japanese quite easily. On the other hand, you know, John Crump was an intellectual and not a barman. He had more difficulty in learning Japanese than Ian Williamson, and the reason would have been because if you're placed in a particular context, you have to learn the language. Maybe not perfectly, well, certainly not perfectly, but enough to be able to speak without even knowing what the grammar is supposed to be. I'm not a language teacher, but a lot of people, you don't learn a language by learning its grammar. You learn a language by actually, speaking it. And I wanted to say something as well on just another anecdote. There was a party sympathizer who came from Azerbaijan or the Azerbaijan part of Iran. And he said that language, which I think is a Turkic language, it was originally written in Arabic script. And then when it was part of Russia, it was written in Russian script. And now it's changed to, Roman script. So, I mean, that is within three generations, they've had to change the writing, the writing thing. I was going to mention that when that was being discussed. But anyway, the subject I wanted to ask you about was, say, bilingualism and learning a second language.
Yeah, I mean, Turkish used to be written in the Arabic script, and then it was changed over to the Roman alphabet. Yeah. I mean, obviously there are disagreements as to how you define bilingualism, degrees of it, and so on. And maybe the 16 people here aren't really a total cross section of the UK population. As for languages are difficult, one thing which might be difficult is there are some languages, for example, Australian languages, in which words are immensely long and complicated, with lots of different bits in them. And that's very unlike English, for instance, and most Indo-European languages. So they might be very difficult, I guess. Not that I want to learn one, but I've read a bit about them, that's all. Mike.
Thanks. Yeah, it was only a sort of a quick point from when Adam said that most of the population of England would be those who sort of speak only the one language. And of course, you know, the sort of stereotype, the generalisation sort of behind that is that English speakers, especially, you know, those in Britain, you know, sort of expect the rest of the world to speak English when they go overseas. So you know, it's partly sort of laziness, and you know, sort of partly sort of there's a lurk in the background. There might be some snobbery there. Whereas, of course, in Europe, you know, a lot of people there, you know, find it more convenient to learn English, you know, alongside picking up their own native language. And again, it's a bit of a generalisation, but you know, that's said to engender a bit more of a sort of open cosmopolitan outlook compared with, as I say, the stereotype of the rather insular English speaking Brit. But I don't know. I suppose all stereotypes maybe have an element of truth in, but yeah, I don't know how far that should be stretched.
Yeah, okay, yeah. John Cumming, I think that is. It's not John Crump, is it?
Yes, I'm a bit ambivalent about the extent to which we should preserve languages, because on the one hand there's the nationalistic element to many of them, but then on the other hand, like you say, there's a lot of knowledge that could be lost. And I mean, the language we all speak, we're not in danger of it dying out, so we don't know what that would feel like. I think that would be quite horrible to think that no one would ever speak English after I die. It wouldn't affect me, but you know, I think that would be really weird. We're not in that position, but there's a richness to language, and that applies to all languages, so far as I can tell. So therefore, you know, I can't really be anything other than ambivalent about it. But I definitely don't like the nationalistic element. Obviously, nobody here does, and there are some people who artificially have encouraged almost dead languages or dying languages to return, and I don't know if that's a sort of natural way for the language to really develop, to have it artificially put on street signs, say in the city centre of Glasgow, where you know you're not going to have people speaking that language. Just about everybody in the city will speak English or a variant of it. So, yeah, it's said the whole thing about languages is quite interesting, and also the nationalism associated with speakers of different languages. But I have noticed a lot of African people seem to be routinely bilingual. They can speak maybe a few African languages, and then a lot of countries in Africa, their official language is English. But a thing that I've noticed is the distinctive way in which people from Nigeria speak English. And I was speaking to somebody from Nigeria, and he heard on my radio people speaking in what he called Nigerian. And I said, no, it's English. But I knew what he meant. He called it Nigerian English. And you get that with, everywhere that's coming under the influence of the English language. I know it with interest that in India, they use English as an official language. And a lot of the news sounds very much like the news from here in the 1950s, but with an Indian accent, which is quite pleasant to listen to, I find. So, yeah, there's all sorts of good things about languages and their interminglings, but sadly some people can become altogether too insular, and you know, it's we see it in a lot of the national anthems of the world. You know, there's a lot of them are pretty warlike, so that's my contribution. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm sure there's such a thing as Nigerian English, just as there's Singapore English and Australian English and so on. Languages become vary depending on what other languages those who speak them speak, and the context in which they've been learned and so on. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Can I speak, Paul? It's Janet Carter. My machine's having a nervous breakdown and I can't get anything up that I want to. It's been fascinating, and could we have another instalment sometime or other or an extension of what we've all touched on? Everybody's reminiscences of their own experiences has been absolutely fascinating. And I'm sure we could all go on for hours.
Please, no.
Are you tired? No. I just was thinking of that. The comedian that came from Dudley, he had what he called a Dudley accent, and I can't remember his name, but he might have been one of the ones that was pushing forward that book of the differences. And there are differences. In London, you can, or some people can tell the difference between East London, South London, North London, and the East End of London, which is a very clear way of, different way of speaking. So it varies from one area to another, less so now, of course, than it ever did. One of my nieces who lives in Italy, or Joe's nieces actually, speaks Italian as a native, but also speaks English very well. But she can tell from which part of Italy someone else comes. So if they live in Rome, they've got a Roman Italian accent. So it must be the same all over everywhere, which is another interesting thing to investigate. And I'll stop there because it's so fascinating. I'll let someone else go on if they want to. Thank you.
Yeah, I don't know Italian. My guess would be that's related to what Howard was saying about there being lots of different varieties of Italian spoken in Italy. An anecdote, so it's going to be a bit unpleasant. I'm sure many of you will remember the Yorkshire Ripper hoaxer, who was known as Wearside Jack, who sent in sort of deliberately misleading phone calls. And the police were able to, or people who worked with him were able to identify that he was from Wearside and some particular area. But I think the general feeling nowadays is that people move around a lot more and are influenced by lots of different kinds of speech. So it's much clearer you can distinguish between someone from London and someone from Birmingham and someone from Liverpool. But it's much harder to be very specific in many cases anyway about where someone comes from, because people are subject to far more influences and come into contact with lots of different varieties of their native language nowadays, certainly more so than was the case, 30, 40 years ago anyway. John again.
Yes, just an observation about different accents. To us, we hear an American accent and, we might know what's someone coming from North or South Carolina. We might have an idea of how they might speak. We can discern differences, but there's a kind of generic American accent that we kind of recognise. And it must be the same with the Hollywood people who seem to mistake Scottish versions of English from Irish versions. And I've experienced the same thing when I was in Isle of Mull back in 1975. There were people there which, there must be an influence between Irish Gaelic and Scottish Gaelic. And a lot of these people to me sounded the same. So I could understand for the first time, perhaps, the Hollywood people who thought Irish and Scottish sounded the same. But it's just like people within relatively short distances, even between Glasgow and Edinburgh, there's a different way of speaking. And it's quite recognisable to people who are closer. They see that difference, but people who are further away don't see that difference. They recognise the similarity, which must come from the common history of certain areas and how they've interacted. So there's all sorts of interesting, fascinating things we could study in language and its development. So that was just something I wanted to observe about language. Oh yes, the other thing I've heard it said, I don't know. I imagine it could be true. Apparently before the films that had a soundtrack, in other words, what the old people of the time called the talkies, when people first heard people speaking and heard an American accent, they laughed because they just thought it was a bit like Captain Mannering. He won't say howdy, partner, put it there. But what happens when the American comes? He says, howdy, partner, put it there. So, you know, yeah, there's all sorts of fun, pleasant things you can say about language. Thanks.
Paul.
Yeah, I remember that scene in the bar, John. It was very, very funny. The other thing I was going to add was almost touching on what Janet just said there, that there can sometimes be, although a slight difference in twang from one end of the city to another, there was quite a sinister development back in the 60s and 70s, I remember, more so less than the 60s, but certainly the 70s, just from my age point of view. Where in Glasgow, the gangs started to develop their own language, you know, and John may or may not remember this as well. And it was traditionally what the East End gangs, they started talking what was called an egg language to try and disguise, you know, what they were saying with each other. And it could be argued that was less of a language and more of speaking in code, if you like. But it was quite obviously, you know, an example would be, you know, how you doing would be, let me think, there's egg, eggy, deggin, egg, eggy, deggin. So you were trying to get the word egg into every sort of sentence in order to, you know, try. It didn't take long before it was broken down, but then again, you know, in the north end of the city, south side of the city, the individual gangs, when they were at their peak, were developing all sorts of variants in that, you know. So there was that side of thing, and then thinking back to what John was touching on, the Canadian and American accents and stuff like that, for those who are particularly nationalistic, if you get a Canadian's nationality mixed up, like I've been to meetings before and I've maybe referred to a point that there was some there from Canada. I thought she was from America, and I made the point, I said, an American friend here, blah, 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 and boy, did she go off on one, you know. She wasn't happy as being referred to an American, even though to me she sounded American, she wasn't flat from Canada. But yeah, that was just another couple of things to throw in amongst you guys, if anyone wanted to comment on that. Cheers.
I'll tell you a little story. I won't tell you the whole context of this, but some years ago, I was with some people who were saying, I'm from so-and-so, I have an American accent or whatever. And I said, I'm from the south of England, so I don't have an accent. Which did get a few laughs, anyway. Not now, maybe, but you did then.
Very good.
Thank you. Yeah, okay. Anybody else? Or shall we... John again, yeah.
Yes, that last comment you made, Paul, was quite interesting. I had a conversation with someone, it was in the course of my work some years ago, and this was someone from Liverpool, and she insisted in using this radio alphabet, which I think is absurd on modern telephones. But anyway, she wanted to use it, and she said, by the way of excuse, in case I can't understand your accent. So I found it amusing to say, oh, no, wait a minute. You're the one with the accent, not me. I think we all kind of think that way.
Yeah, okay, thanks. So should we call it a day then, since nobody else seems to wish to contribute? Okay, so next week it's Dougie, is it, on the news? Is that right?
Yes, Dougie's agreed to do that.
Is there a crowd where you are, Adam?
I'm outside in the garden.
Well, you've got a garden, bloody hell.
Thanks, Paul. Thanks very much, Paul. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Paul.
Cheers, Paul. Good night, Paul.
Good night.
Enough respect, then.
Bye.